From NPR and WBUR, I'm Callum Borchers.
And I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. President Biden is sending officials to Mexico and Guatemala to try to stem the tide of migrants coming to the U.S. southern border. Crossings there are reaching a level not seen in two decades, and new images from inside of a Texas shelter where migrant children and families are being kept show cramped makeshift conditions. And on NBC yesterday, Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas insisted the Biden administration has the situation under control.
Our message has been straightforward and simple, and it's true. The border is closed. We are expelling families. We are expelling single adults. And we've made a decision that we will not expel young, vulnerable children.
To get more perspective on this, we're joined now by Andrea Rudnick. She's co-founder of Team Brownsville, a volunteer group which helps migrants on both sides of the border. And Andrea, the Biden administration doesn't want to call this a crisis, but what is it for your organization? How many people are actually coming to Brownsville each day?
Currently, we are seeing about 100 young families and children coming to our bus station area, being released by CBP on a daily basis. This is in addition to people that are crossing back into the United States. They had been returned to Mexico with a program called Migrant Protection Protocol. So both populations are now streaming into our bus station.
What are their needs? What are some of their needs and what happens to them?
Well, their needs are very basic. They need things like clothing, diapers, food, blankets, pillows, things that will allow them to travel to their families in the United States. They are COVID tested at our bus station. They get bus tickets. They get their families pay for bus tickets or airline tickets as well as hotel reservations if they need that. We also have shelter arrangements for those that cannot afford to pay for a hotel. So their needs are many and just as varied as the many different types of people that we receive.
Absolutely. We heard earlier that officials are going to Mexico and Guatemala to try to stem the tide of migrants coming to the U.S. southern border. What can be done from your view to stem the tide of people? Why are they telling you they're coming in such huge numbers?
Well, people are fleeing for a number of different reasons. Some tell us they're fleeing because of hurricanes and other weather situations that have affected their communities where their whole homes and livelihoods have been wiped out. Others tell us because of political unrest, because of gang violence, because of police abuses. Stories vary from person to person and country to country.
Yeah. Are they learning about the politics that are happening over here? Do they know about some of the Biden administration's attempts to stem them crossing over to this side of the country?
I think that some people do know about that, and they are feeling like they need to get to the border as quickly as possible. They're unsure about what's going to happen if they are told that they cannot apply for asylum at the border, that they must apply in their home countries. And so I think there's some urgency to their travel to the border to apply for asylum.
And what is the situation on the other side of the border in Mexico, where your organization also helps people?
Well, currently, it's getting to be a very desperate situation. There are people that are coming to the border expecting to be able to cross and apply for asylum, only to be told that because of a law called, which is a very old law called Title 42, that was reinstated about a year ago, they're not able to cross the bridge and legally present themselves for asylum. They have to go back into Mexico and wait until that law is lifted. So people are on the streets. People are sleeping on the streets, on the sidewalk. Some people are going to shelters. It's getting to be a very desperate situation in the border communities.
Well, Andrea, I appreciate you sharing a bit of what your organization does and the realities down there at the southern border. Andrea Rutnick is co-founder of Team Brownsville, a volunteer group which helps migrants on both sides of the border. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
And now to that promising preliminary data released today from AstraZeneca about its COVID-19 vaccine. Two doses were shown to be 79% effective at preventing symptomatic COVID-19 and 100% effective at preventing severe disease and hospitalization. The trial also showed no instances of blood clotting after a small number of recipients developed blood clots in other countries. And AstraZeneca's vaccine is already rolling out globally. Let's bring in Dr. Angela Rasmussen. She's a virologist at Georgetown's Center for Global Health Science and Security. Dr. Rasmussen, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
We're glad to have you with some good news. I'm hoping you can fill in some more detail about what we learned about this vaccine today and how does it compare to the other vaccines that are already authorized for emergency use here in the U.S.
Well, we actually still don't know that much about this vaccine because they haven't released a paper that allows us to examine the full set of data. But what we do know is great news. So this vaccine was almost 80% efficacious at preventing symptomatic COVID-19 of any kind and 100% effective preventing severe disease and hospitalization. What's going to be important is looking at how many patients that actually includes, especially for the severe disease. But overall, this is fantastic news. It's consistent with what's been seen in other trials, and it suggests that we may just have a fourth vaccine to add to our collection.
Yeah, so in that vein, I mean, this vaccine, if it does get emergency use, it still may not be available for some weeks, but we do have other vaccines from other companies ramping up production over that time. So how will it fit into the puzzle of the U.S. vaccination effort?
We still don't actually have enough supply of vaccines, of all three vaccines that are currently authorized, to really get everybody who needs a vaccine. So this will definitely fit in terms of being able to immunize more people and get us closer to the herd immunity threshold. Once we're there, this will also be incredibly helpful at getting this vaccine out to the rest of the world as well.
I want to dig in to the blood clot issue a little bit, Dr. Rasmussen, because this was something that held up its rollout in the EU. A number of countries had temporarily halted use of the AstraZeneca vaccine because they were concerned about blood clots that a small number of patients developed. But the EU's drug regulator has since said the vaccine doesn't increase the overall incidence of blood clots. So what else did we learn about that today?
So the nice thing about this trial is that there's really no data indicating that during this trial there were any of those blood clotting issues observed. So that would be consistent with what the EU's regulator has said, that these blood clots are not associated with the vaccine.
So let's look at the big picture here, Dr. Rasmussen. I mean, the Biden administration had initially set a goal of 100 million doses in 100 days. It's now saying we could get to 200 million doses by the 100th day in office, which would blow past the original goal. So how would you characterize the way the vaccination effort is going right now?
Pleasantly surprised. After some early challenges in terms of the rollout and the distribution, I'm very happy to see that we are now vaccinating people at a very brisk pace. But that said, I think that there still remain some issues with vaccine equity that haven't been addressed. In many major cities, there are far more white people, far more people from a higher socioeconomic background receiving the vaccine. We still need to do much better at making sure this vaccine is getting out to everybody who needs it.
Well, to that point, there's sort of a racial discrepancy, there's a socioeconomic discrepancy, and a geographic one as well. We know one of the difficulties has been getting the vaccine into rural areas. This new data from the AstraZeneca vaccine would seem to be a step forward because it's another one along with the J&J vaccine that can go into the regular old fridge, right? I mean, is that a big deal?
That's a huge deal. That's a big deal for both the U.S. as well as vaccinating globally. In that these vaccines, the Johnson & Johnson and AstraZeneca, are viral vectored vaccines. They don't require ultra cold chain storage over long term. So you can distribute them in places that may not have that type of infrastructure.
Even as we take in this good news, though, Dr. Rasmussen, how concerned do you remain about what we're seeing in states like Texas, where they're lifting mask mandates, or in Florida, where we're seeing large groups of people gathering for spring break? There still seems to be some potential for upticks in infections, even as the vaccine rollout continues to go better than it has in the early going.
I'm definitely concerned about that. I think that we really have lifted a lot of the precautions prematurely. It's wonderful that we have these vaccines, and that is, over the long term, our way to end this pandemic. But we need to also make sure that we are taking steps to mitigate transmission risk until enough people can be vaccinated. Right now, I think, is not the time to be having large gatherings for spring break, especially indoor gatherings. It's not the time to be lifting mask mandates. We need to make sure that we're keeping transmission low as we get immunization up.
Dr. Angela Rasmussen is a virologist at Georgetown Center for Global Health Science and Security, speaking with us as the U.S. gets closer to authorizing the AstraZeneca COVID-19 vaccine. Dr. Rasmussen, thanks a lot.
Thanks so much for having me, Callum.
Hundreds gathered in Georgia over the weekend to mourn the victims of last week's shooting and call for an end to anti-Asian racism. Similar demonstrations took place in several other cities as the cries for justice grow louder. Let's bring in Emil Moffitt. He's a reporter at WABE in Atlanta. And Emil, how are people there remembering and honoring those 8 lives lost, 6 of whom were Asian women?
They were remembered as hardworking people who were toiling at these frontline jobs in the pandemic, trying to support their families. The words underappreciated and invisible were heard a lot over the weekend. And then to be targeted as they went about their work really saddened, angered, and scared many people who came out to these vigils, including Connie Ji. She works for an organization that supports Asian communities here in Atlanta.
I'm afraid myself too, actually. We are fear. We are come to here for make a better life. We should working for a better life in our community.
And that was a sentiment shared by a lot of folks we talked to this weekend, not only the shootings last week in Atlanta, but also the rise in hate crimes and ugly rhetoric toward Asian people in the last year. A lot of folks hoping that this marks a turning point in trying to end those things.
What were some of the other calls to action you heard over this weekend? What did you hear from demonstrators?
Yeah, there was a lot of frustration, especially in the Asian community, where they expressed that this discrimination has gone on for far too long, and it hasn't always gotten the attention that it deserves. The suspect in this case, of course, has told police that his motivation was what he described as a sexual addiction, and he was trying to, in his words, remove temptation. But the demonstrators at this rally were just not buying that at all. They say the fact that he targeted Asian-owned businesses and their Asian employees, all of them women, by the way, and regardless of what he says was the reason, they say that proves that this was a hate crime not only against Asians, but against women, too.
Emil, I only have about 30 seconds with you, but Georgia's new senators, Raphael Warnock and John Ossoff, also spoke. What did they say?
Yeah, Senator Warnock said that laws need to be strengthened at the state and federal level when it comes to protecting minority communities. Senator Ossoff says, "This is just not who Georgia is anymore. Georgia is a rapidly diversifying state," and he says it needs to be reflected in that way.
Emil Moffitt is a reporter at member station WABE. As always, thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, nearly a week after those killings, law enforcement agents are not calling the killings a hate crime, as you heard, saying that the accused shooter told them his motives were not racial, but instead motivated by his attempt to eliminate temptation because of a sexual addiction. But legal analysts, historians, and activists argue that it's impossible to divorce race and gender from this violence, that for over a century, Asian women have been sexualized, stereotyped, and targeted. Among them are Sung Yong Choi Morrow, executive director of the National Asian Pacific American Women's Forum. And she joins us now. Thank you for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Yes, absolutely. You've said killing Asian American women to eliminate a man's temptation speaks to the history of the objectification of Asian and Asian American women. This is a major point on why you and others argue it's impossible to exclude race as a motive for these brutal killings. Say more.
Sure. You know, from beginning of history in the United States of when Asian American women came to this country, Asian American women have always been sexualized and objectified. 1875, the Page Act was passed by Congress, and it essentially says that it wants to ban East Asian women from entering the United States because we come here to be prostitutes. I mean, so from the get-go, we've always been seen as temptresses and sexual objects. And so the fact that those were the words used by the killer to describe Asian American women cannot be separated from these historical contexts from which we come from.
And you talk about the late 1800s. I mean, this continued to play out through World War II and the Korean War.
That's correct. And so you fast forward into World War II, the Korean War, the Vietnam War. You know, I myself am actually an immigrant from Korea. When I was little, we saw the militarism and the military presence in Korea and the demand for sex workers and how that's really shaped how military service people from the United States view Asian women. And so when I came to this country, I've received very specifically racialized sexual harassment because of my Korean background.
Yes, over the last few days, we've heard these really disturbing stories from Asian women who are speaking out about these types of fantasies that men feel that they can just tell them or say to them. And as you mentioned, you've also experienced this as well. Can you share more about some of the things that happened to you and some of the conversations that men feel like they can have with you?
Yeah, I mean, quote unquote, polite ones, you know, like acquaintances feel the need to tell me how much they love Asian women, you know, or they use that as a pickup line to indicate that I'm the type that they like, right? So there's always this projecting of their preferences when it comes to who they want to have sexual relationships with that are thrown at Asian and Asian American women in this country. And in the more scarier forms are street harassment where, you know, I'm walking down the street and somebody will stop me and ask me if I'm Korean. And, you know, it sounds very innocent. And, you know, I'm like, yeah, I'm Korean. And they would say, oh, you know, I served at this military base. Do you know the city? Do you know the city? And talk about how they love Korea and Korean food. And but most of all, how they love Korean women and how I remind them of some girlfriend they had. And then we'll say something really sexually inappropriate. And that encounter has happened to me multiple times, not just once, but multiple times. And, you know, now it's not that it doesn't happen as often. It's that I've figured out how to avoid those conversations. You know, I just don't talk to people on the streets anymore. I just, you know, and then I get the, well, why don't you smile a little? You know, Asian girls look good when they smile, stuff like that, right? So it's always racialized. You know, women are publicly harassed all the time. But for Asian American women, it is really also racialized. It's not just because we're women.
I want to talk with you more about the victims. And you talk about these spas and or massage parlors. We know that some of them do have sex work going on. And we also know through extensive reporting that some of them house women who work unwillingly, who are trafficked or pimped. Others have chosen sex work for many reasons. But you say we don't care much about those women as a society because we just assume this is what Asian women do. So we don't regulate these workplaces or ensure these women's safety. Instead, we raid them and penalize them instead of trying to make conditions better.
That's right. It's about Asian women who may be trafficked or are choosing to do the work, who are not being protected because of the kind of work they do. And it also is about broadly women of color in sex work who are targets of sexual violence. And so I think it's really important to bring the whole narrative into the picture because women of color have been killed and murdered in this country for a very long time as a crime of sexual violence, and very little attention is ever paid to that. And so I think to your point that, you know, they raid these places and then they criminalize them, we need to protect people's work no matter what they do as work and provide rights and dignity because at the end of the day, when they don't have protection, they're more vulnerable and susceptible to violence.
The last few years have been brutal for many Asian Americans. The former president used racial slurs to describe the coronavirus. There's also been a substantial increase in the number of reported acts of violence against Asian Americans. And as you laid out, it doesn't start or end there. What do you want to see moving forward?
I think this is just the start of the conversation. While I'm really relieved that finally we're having conversations that we've been wanting to have for a very long time, it's come at the cost of 8 lives, 6 of them being Asian American women. And I've had so many reporters and people tell me, like, I had no idea that's how you were being treated and that's how Asian American women are treated in our society, you know? And so I'm glad that that curtain's been drawn back, but I think moving forward, we need to really think hard about, you know, wherever you are in your race, gender, age, class, what are you doing to make sure to uphold the dignity of Asian American women as human beings? Everything from simple things that we do in our American culture that really objectifies and exotifies Asian heritage and Asian American culture, how some people do makeup and make their eyes look like quote unquote Asian eyes, or Halloween costumes, for example. You know, we are not a Halloween costume. And I think those are different ways that we need to really start thinking about critically how we actively or passively play into creating this culture where Asian American women are objectified and not really treated with this human dignity. And that led to the tragic shooting that was intentionally targeted at those six women, not only because they were Asian American or only because they were women, but because they were Asian American women, you know? And so I see so many people going on talk shows and, you know, TV and radio, really just framing this in relationship to the coronavirus and the history of hate crimes against Asian Americans, and really erasing the fact that these were women and that's why they were targeted as well. I hope it we for once as a nation can walk and chew gum at the same time, where we can talk about race and gender. And so that is my hope as we move forward with more conversations and actions.
Sunyoung Choi Morrow is Executive Director of the National Asian Pacific Women's Forum. I really appreciate you, and I appreciate this conversation.
Thank you for having me.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Zooty. Why spend months coding when you can build powerful, customized applications in days? Zooty offers an affordable solution to build apps for your business, apps that integrate into all your current systems and data sources. And your Zooty subscription always includes unlimited apps and unlimited users. Learn more at Zooty.com.
On NPR's Consider This podcast, we don't just catch you up on the news. We help you make sense of what's happening, whether it's how to tackle the challenges that come with pregnancy during a pandemic or how to understand the crisis unfolding along our southern border. We'll fill you in for 15 minutes every weekday. Listen now to Consider This from NPR.
It's been a year since the pandemic flipped the economy upside down. On March 23rd, 2020, the plunging stock market hit bottom amid record unemployment claims and the worst financial crisis since the Great Depression. Now the market's recovering faster than many economists expected. For more on what this means for your money, we're joined by personal finance expert Jill Schlesinger. She's a CBS News business analyst and host of Jill on Money. Hey, Jill.
Hello.
So if the flashback isn't too painful, Jill, take us back to March 23rd, 2020 and the days and weeks that followed.
It was really scary. And I think it was scary for a lot of reasons, but not the least of which is we couldn't understand in that moment what would occur in the short term that would help kind of allay the fears of investors. Those fears being that we're shutting an economy down and which companies are going to be able to survive that. We didn't know.
And I know that investors who stayed the course, as you recommended, are reaping those rewards now. And as you say that we lost a third of the market value, well, a lot of stocks now are trading 50% higher. I mean, in other words, they've not only recovered what they lost, they're actually above that. And it seems, Jill, that even while much of the rest of the economy is faltering, the stock market has actually been high rolling for most of the pandemic. I mean, what's behind that disconnect?
You know, it is always so difficult to imagine that, because you're right. And we still have about 9 million fewer jobs than we had before the pandemic started. And yet, why is the stock market rising? Well, it is a combination of factors, because now, after that initial stimulus, we have had two more rounds. So we've had $5 trillion pushed into the economy to help businesses and people who have been impacted by the virus. We've had the Federal Reserve maintaining these low interest rates and buying bonds to stabilize the financial system. But, you know, we also have a vaccine that's come up online in a year. And you put these three things together, and what investors do is they look to the future. What the looking forward process does, it says which companies will make money, how much money over the course of the future months and years ahead. And that's the bet that's put on the table. Should also be very clear that there is a lot of what we call asset inflation going on. There's a lot of money sloshing around the system, And right now, that money is going into things like stocks or Bitcoin or non-fungible tokens, whatever it is, because people don't have a good idea of what to do with their money if they don't actually need the money they have on hand.
Well, so what's your advice then for folks looking ahead? Because they may be tempted to say, oh, I'm going to pull out of bonds and they're relatively low yields. The stock market's roaring. I'm going to go all in on stocks. What's your guidance?
My guidance is to remember the fear and pain that you felt a year ago and to understand that asset allocation really does mean that there are some parts of your portfolio that aren't going to do as well as others at various times. And I don't know when those roles get reversed. So a year ago, I would never have guessed that we would see stocks at these levels. I don't think most people would have. And now that we are at these levels, I would be really careful. I think that we always have to really consider our personal financial security first. We've got to have that 6 to 12 months of our living expenses as a safety net. We do want to pay down debt. We do want to participate in retirement plans. And if you were to have a $1,400 stimulus check that you just don't need, sure, you could take a flyer on the next GameStop. On the other hand, if you do that, just know that could vanish. And how would you feel if that happened?
That's Jill Schlesinger, CBS News business analyst and host of Jill on Money. Jill, thanks as always.
Great to be with you.
Academy Award nominations are out, and Judas and the Black Messiah is up for 5 Oscars, including Best Picture. Director Shaka King was nominated for co-writing the screenplay. The film tells the story of Fred Hampton, the chairman of the Chicago Black Panthers in the late 1960s. He's played by Oscar nominee Daniel Kaluuya.
You can murder a liberator, but you can't murder liberation. You can murder a revolutionary, but you can't murder revolution. And you can murder a freedom fighter, but you can't murder freedom.
Hampton was killed in December of 1969 in a police raid orchestrated by the FBI. And this film lays out how that came to be by also telling the story of William O'Neill, a man recruited by the FBI to spy on the Panther organization. O'Neill provided the FBI with the floor plan to Hampton's apartment prior to that raid. Lakeith Stanfield received his first Oscar nomination for embodying this complicated role of William O'Neill, and I spoke with him when the film was released last month. Okay, so Judas and the Black Messiah. Lakeith, if Fred Hampton was the Black Messiah, that makes you Judas. What was it that drew you to this role?
Yeah, that makes William O'Neill Judas. What drew me to the role was actually not the role itself. It was the idea that I would be playing Chairman Fred Hampton, because that's what I assumed I would be doing when I got the script. Because I was one of the first people that was approached about the film. Shaka and I knew each other. And he had told me about a film he was just writing that chronicled a story in the Black Panther Party. And I was just really excited to hear that, because I always wanted to do a movie that talked about these themes, especially the Black Panther Party, who I loved growing up. And then he told me I'd be playing William O'Neill. And I was like, womp, womp, womp. That is until I started doing a little bit of digging into O'Neill as much as I could and trying to find who he really was and what motivated him. And I realized a lot of what motivated him was just his own fear with not being able to be free, not being able to live his life, which at age 17, which is when he came in contact with the FBI, is something that's really big to you, your freedom.
Right. And I want to get into that freedom because, I mean, we see all of this in the film because money is a motivator. Poverty is a motivator, all of those things. There's a scene in the film with you and Jesse Plemons, who plays FBI agent Roy Mitchell, O'Neill's FBI recruiter. And Mitchell believes the Panthers are a threat. He even says they are the same as the KKK. Your character seems more concerned in this particular scene with getting paid. Let's listen.
Hey, how much money you make, man?
It's living.
So, like, say I get you, like, some good information, something nobody else know. Is it some kind of bonus or something?
Well, I'm counting on it, Bill. But to answer your question, you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours.
This is such a powerful scene because it subtly underscores what desperation and poverty can make us do. How do you interpret O'Neill's decisions?
Particularly in that scene, I feel like O'Neill, he the kind of character that we want to portray was one that was young, scrappy, that was kind of into street kind of life, who would do things like steal cars, anything he could do for money. So he was the kind of person that really valued money and power. And so when he was faced with an FBI agent that might offer this kind of power that he always thrived to have, and money, goodness, that's freedom, isn't it? And that's mm-hmm. what he equated those things to. And so his ambition was to have that even over, you know, over a group that he wasn't politically aligned with. Now, a lot of people like to think that people were, you know, especially Black people in the country at the time, were either Black Panther Party, rah, rah, really with it, ready to put your life on the line to see change, or that you hated yeah. Black people.
We're always talking about it in this way, this binary way. Absolutely.
Yeah. And I think there's there's a middle spot where there were some people who weren't necessarily down with what the Black Panthers were doing, but also weren't politically, you know, apolitical. And so I think there's an interesting version of a Black person you get to see in some moments with O'Neal, where it's not that he's all the way, you know, sort of radicalized into the establishment status quo, and he's not all the way into the rebellion either. He's like, look, I just want to make some money. But I think mm-hmm. that decision, it caused more decisions down the line. If you watch the movie, you'll see it just gets worse and worse for him. He starts out doing yeah. things that just like, wherever I'm moving, and then you find yourself in a spot where now you have to make a really tough and bad decision.
Do you see him as someone that we should sympathize with?
Yeah, you know, it's a tough thing because on one hand, you have someone that did something that was obviously very reprehensible and helped cause the death of someone that we hold in really high esteem and regard. We also have to understand that William O'Neal is not the only part of this puzzle. In fact, the U.S. government is arguably a bigger part of the puzzle. So to me, if there's a constituency that really deserves to be scrutinized in a huge way, not to say that he doesn't, because William O'Neal definitely made his own decisions. And I don't agree with a lot of the stuff that he did. And I don't think we should herald him as a hero. I think we should learn from him. But the government mm-hmm. themselves, we have to put them up on the block of judgment, so to speak, to say, why were you guys doing this? Why did you choose the Black Panther Party to be the number one threat to America? While meanwhile, there are people that are members of the KKK still occupying slots in office. I think we have to, you know, really hold them accountable for a lot of the stuff that went on there.
Mm-hmm. Lakeith, before I let you go, I got to ask you, you're drawn to roles where characters go through transformations. In Atlanta and Sorry to Bother You and Short Term 12, how has playing Bill O'Neal changed you?
William O'Neal has presented the most challenging role I've ever had to play. I never really had played a character yet where I really had to dive deep into my own moral standing and go against that in order to find something in the character that made the character playable to me or made it make sense to me in a way. So, you know, it was a struggle being on set every day. There would be times where I questioned whether or not it was the right decision to even depict this character and how to balance that out. So it was tough, but I'm really glad I went through it. You know, I learned a lot from it.
I can imagine. And I think people are going to take away so much of what you said in watching this film. You know, I also want to ask you something else. It's about your social media persona. I follow you on Insta. I watch your Instagram lives, Lakeith. I'm always mm-hmm. thinking, okay, who is Lakeith going to be today? Why do you do this? And how do you decide what version of yourself you're going to show us? Because I think a lot of people follow celebrities because they're thinking they're going to get a sense of the real person.
I have an imagination and I love having fun. And I don't really take things too seriously, you know, and a lot of times my social media presence reflects that. I have fun with the thought and I just love engaging with the audience and laughing with people. And so that's a lot of what you'll see. But yeah, I love acting too. So you might see me show up as a different persona. You might see me show up as someone unrecognizable from the person that you
know.
Yeah,
you were the Joker like a year ago.
Yeah. So, yeah, I just have fun with it, you know, and engage with it. And, you know, so certain opportunities, it's used as something that can be a force for good as well. Like my music, which is coming soon,
yes.
Which will also be featured heavily on my social media. Actually, if you want to see the realest side of me, you'll see that in my music. So.
It's reflected in your music. Okay, I lied. I have one more question. You know, aside from your innate talent, one of the big appeals is that you feel like a normal guy. I mean, like the boy Lakeith I went to school with or the guy who lives across the street. I mean, do you feel like the blossoming of your career is in a way a testament to change in Hollywood?
I don't know. I don't really look to Hollywood like that. I don't got that much faith in Hollywood because to me, Hollywood's a business and it's not really a spiritual movement type thing as people try to make it to be really sometimes. I think that because of the thing that we do, which is storytelling, which is on such a grand and, you know, very large scale, it seems like Hollywood is the bearer of the souls, but really the souls are the bearer of Hollywood. And the way that we live life and the things that we do and experience, Hollywood tries to reflect. So if we don't like what we're seeing in Hollywood, it's like the lives we live got to be different. The real important thing is us being able to break out from the inside out and be better versions of ourselves than we were yesterday. And then Hollywood will reflect that inevitably anyway, because they're trying to keep up.
Because they're trying to keep up. I love it. Lakeith Stanfield, star of Judas and the Black Messiah, thank you so much for this conversation and thank you for your work.
Thank you very much.
That's Oscar nominee for Best Supporting Actor Lakeith Stanfield. The Academy Awards are on April 25th.
Police departments in New York State have until April 1st to make reforms that address systemic racism. The mandate came after George Floyd was killed by police in Minneapolis last May. In small cities and towns upstate, the process has revealed deep divisions in the way people think about racial bias and policing. North Country Public Radio's Emily Russell reports.
For months after the killing of George Floyd, people around the country flooded the streets. They held signs that read, "I can't breathe," and "Black Lives Matter." There were big rallies in cities and towns across New York, like this one in Plattsburgh. In June, Governor Andrew Cuomo unveiled a new mandate. Every law enforcement agency in New York had to make reforms aimed specifically at reducing racial bias.
We're not going to fund police agencies in this state that do not look at what has been happening, come to terms with it, and reform themselves.
Agencies are required to meet with the public to work on these reforms. The Sheriff's Department in Franklin County along the Canadian border held a public meeting last month. People asked about the use of chokeholds, about the need for body cameras. One woman, Colleen Farmer, asked about racism.
What specific systemic racism has been found within your department at this point?
There was a long pause before Undersheriff Terrence White answered.
Systemic racism? None.
His boss, Sheriff Kevin Mulverhill, then stepped in.
I don't see where systemic racism is mentioned at all in the governor's executive order.
The governor's order does, in fact, mention racism multiple times. It specifically mentions systemic racial bias. Henry Smart says this back and forth at Franklin County's meeting does not surprise him. Smart is a professor at New York's John Jay College of Criminal Justice.
Of course, your defensive answer immediately is like, no. I'm not racist. And you could very well not be an actively hating on a group, a total group. But we're all participating in systemic racism. We're all doing it.
Smart says one of the problems with the state's mandate is that it doesn't require someone at these meetings who is trained to guide discussions on systemic racism.
If we want to have these dialogues, we have to define what these concepts are for folks and explain it in a way that doesn't single them out or ostracize them in the way that these behaviors have done to marginalized groups in this country.
Nikki Hilton Patterson was at Franklin County's meeting. She's a Black woman who heads the Adirondack Diversity Initiative. Hilton Patterson stepped in and tried to explain that there are different kinds of racism.
The problem with talking about race and understanding race and racism is that we hyper-focus on individual acts. Structural racism is a totally different beast.
It's why Black people earn a third less than white people. It's why Black men are six times more likely to end up in prison. There are racial disparities in education, homeownership, life expectancy because of systemic racism. Without understanding and accepting this fact, some of these meetings are getting bogged down or going off the rails. At a police reform meeting in a small village of Potsdam in December, the conversation shifted from the Black experience to what police were going through, how the community can support them better. John Youngblood, who teaches at the local college, pushed back.
You talk about humanizing the police. We're here because of the issue with the police not humanizing African Americans. How did we jump from one to the other so quickly?
Youngblood and the only other Black member of the Reform Committee resigned after that meeting. At other meetings, language has been explicit. The city of Glens Falls had to shut down its meeting in February after some people over Zoom started using the N-word. New York's attorney general is investigating. It's unclear if the people using the racial slurs were local or not. It's also unclear whether this whole process will lead to a reckoning with systemic racism. Here's Franklin County Sheriff Kevin Mulverhill in a follow-up interview.
I think the governor is reacting to a national issue, and that's fine, and that's his prerogative. I don't think that systemic racism is necessarily inherent in every system.
According to the NAACP, though, Black people are more likely than white people to be pulled over, to be searched, to be shot and killed by police. As a Black man, Henry Smart from John Jay College says he does everything he can to avoid an encounter with the police.
I'm not going to pick up the phone. I'm going to call the cops. No, they may show up, see me, and just shoot. Yeah, I don't take that risk.
Nikki Hilton Patterson from the Adirondack Diversity Initiative said she's also felt targeted by police because she's Black. But she says she's focusing on the long view, hoping that by requiring training, making reforms, and just talking about systemic racism, a difference can be made down the road.
The data shows that it takes 2 years to change behaviors and 5 years to change attitudes. And so that's what we're planning for.
Some departments in upstate New York are making changes. Officers in St. Lawrence County are now wearing body cameras. The city of Plattsburgh is considering doing the same. There's more focus on mental health and social services. And a lot of communities want officers to get implicit bias training. That'll help them better understand and be aware of systemic racism. For Here and Now, I'm Emily Russell.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Callum Borchers.
And I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.